bomb everything.
I just thought the limited range of the FPV drones make him difficult without fiber optics. But you're saying it's not hard to develop to develop FPV drones that could reach Kyrgyzstan, 30 whatever kilometers.
Oh, they already are. The difficulty is in line of sight communications and having a large enough battery pack that they can fly that far. When you can put up larger drones, what the Ukrainians use, the Baba Yaga. Russia has its own larger drones that retranslate the signal. It's like an internet retranslator. So you bounce a signal off the drone, it bounces back to the operator, and you extend their range. The effective range right now on the battlefield is up to 50 kilometers from the battlefield. You can get drones in. I mean, I've been in Avdiivka when enemy drones flying overhead and then being shot down, and that happens every day. And Avdiivka is about the medium rear. The front is 30 kilometers further west. Yeah, and drones fly every single day over there from the Ukrainian side, and Russian drones fly deep in. And that's, again, without loitering munitions and other types of warhead. This is just regular FPV drones. Technology's moved advanced ahead quite a bit. So, I mean, that's what these guys are going to be facing. They're going to be facing being attacked by drones day and night. Drones are cheap. Night optics these days are not expensive to put on a drone. Day and night, they're going to have drones coming in. Again, you can't cover the entire coastline to try to find that 1, 2, 10, 20, 50 kids or Iranian soldiers who are going to be launching drones over and over and over. That's a little problem. Now, if the reason you have fiber optic is because they're harder to jam. In fact, you can't use the radio signal jammers on the fiber optic because their signals are coming down the fiber optic line. You could do that. And fiber optical drones can go 30, 40 kilometers because they're bigger ones. They'll have a bigger spool of fiber optic cable in the back. You may have to put a slightly smaller charge on them versus an RPG. You know, you may be a smaller RPG round, like an RPG 6 or an RPG 4. But you can put a smaller mine on there to explode, but to make up for the weight of the spool. But it's not that heavy. So there's the problem. You can cover Karg Island. By the way, same thing if they try to take the coastline of the Straits of Hormuz. It's going to be a turkey shoot. No prepared positions. You're out in the open ahead of your mountains. And guess what's coming off the mountains? You're having FPV drones. I'm not even talking about heavier drones like Shahids or Garand 3s that can come down and strike larger targets. I'm not talking about loitering munitions. Yeah, I mean, this is the reality. And if you can't suppress and push them out, you know, you're just on an island.
So, but the goal is to take these islands throughout the Strait of Hormuz and use those, you know, install radars in those islands to be able to intercept any missiles or drones, to be able to assess your control of a kind of a controlled buffer zone for the ships to be able to pass through, prevent Iran from being able to strike the ships. So that is the objective. But what you're saying is that, number one, the American troops in those islands will become sitting ducks for drones. And by the way, you're not the only one that said that. As well as artillery. You didn't talk about the, maybe you mentioned it, all the artillery guns on the coastline as well. And the ongoing missile strikes that Iran continues to strike with the Gulf. It could use a very short range missiles for these islands.
Right. The short range missiles are more likely what you're going to be winding up from the heavier aspects. The problem with tube artillery, even if it's deployed on an elevator, shaft is it self-identifies the moment it fires because you have radar systems that can are set out in front and they can study the trajectory velocity. It's a ballistic round, so you've got a parabolic curve on it, and you can study out where it came from by velocity, by speed, by velocity, by angle of approach, and you can kind of figure out where the enemy is and attack those locations. That's what you get A-10s or F-15s on standoff that can launch missiles into that location. That's problem with tube artillery. On the other hand, rocket artillery, you drive out somewhere, you shoot, and the moment that rocket takes off, you're gone. You're on your way out. By the time anybody can track a ballistic missile out from where it came from, there's nobody there anymore. That's, by the way, self-propelled artillery works the same way. It stops for 2 minutes to fire or less. Depends how many rounds it wants to fire, and keeps going. By the time counter battery artillery comes in, there's nothing there. You're just shooting into an empty field or an empty building or an empty forest line. And that's the problem when you have mechanized. If you have tube artillery that's planted in an area, and if it lifts off an elevator, you can identify where it's coming from. And that becomes a problem. But rocket artillery, it'll do a lot of damage. Even something as basic as a Grodd system. That can pump 120-millimeter rockets on top, a dozen 120-millimeter rockets on top of a grid square. Now, having said that, let's look at the Straits of Hormuz realistically. The main dredged route, the Straits of Hormuz are not deep. There is a main dredged route that goes around the tip. It is 2,700 meters wide. That's what all your tankers and any heavier ships would have to traverse down that route. It's not hard to close down. It's actually quite easy to close down. If you sink one or two of them, now they're going to be in the way of anything else coming down. You have to dredge them out. You're not going to dredge them under fire. So the Iranians have, you have to, theoretically, if you really want to take control, you need to drop enough troops to go up in the mountains and keep pushing them back at least 30 kilometers from the coastline. It's not 40 kilometers. U.S. does not have the strength for that. Nor the U.S. When the casualties start coming in the thousands, as the U.S. is going to be, or the Donald Trump administration going to be able to handle this. Never mind how to feed, supply the soldiers that have to do this. Look, you know, when you had D-Day, you had 125,000 troops coming in. You had manufactured ports that were towed over, and their job wasn't to take the beach. Their job was to take the battle positions behind the beach and keep pushing the Germans back as far as they could away from the beach for a reason that the Germans couldn't then shell the beach front. And that was cliffs in one area and just a small hillock in another area of the beach. Depends what part of the beach you're in. But either way, after that, it was relatively flat. Probably had a lot of hedgerows. But it wasn't a mountain. It wasn't a mountain range. So we're talking an absolutely different aspect. And, you know, we're first, there was 125,000 a landing. You're going to land, what, 10,000 against an entrenched enemy in the mountains? It's suicide. It is absolute suicide. It's a butcher's bill that the U.S. is going to have to pay for ethereal gains.
Is there any comparisons we can make to the Iran-Iraq war where Iran had hundreds of thousands of troops? Iraq and was still not able to invade Iran and still lost the war. What was Iran's strategy in that war? I'm not sure if you know the details.
Iraq did invade Iran. That's the whole point. They did. And they invaded first and primarily in the southwest of the northern tip near Kuwait, because that's more or less flat lands and there's a lot of oil fields in that area. And Iraq was pushed on and supplied by the U.S. And yes, it went back and forth. Iran did not have a lot of armor, so it used infantry, used a lot of infantry suicidal charges. I mean, it played with the cards it was dealt with, the equipment that it held. U.S. Was supplying Iraq. In fact, so was the Soviet Union supplying Iraq. Iraq had the technological advantage. Iran had the human capital. And yes, Iraq lost that war. It was pushed out. It took heavy casualties. That's when the U.S. started supplying Iraq with chemical weapons. And Iraq killed almost 1 million people with chemical weapons. Also killed Kurds. It also killed the swamp Arabs who are Shia. They used chemical weapons in every single direction. And the U.S. was happy with that. They had no problems with that. So that, one of the reasons that Saddam didn't think the U.S. was actually going to invade him, because just 2 years earlier, they were the best of friends. And Rumsfeld was over there and Cheney was over there at various times. Shaking Sand Cheney was the Minister of Defense or Secretary of Defense. Let me phrase that, under George Bush Sr. Let's not forget that. They had that effect. But, you know, what the point is here that everybody's ignoring is the U.S. and Israel accomplished regime change, generational regime change. They took out the older generation that wanted to talk to them, that was willing to negotiate with them. And they replaced them with the 50-somethings. The 50-somethings, like Khamenei, who spent when he was 17, went to the front as a volunteer infantryman. These are the guys that spent their youth, that was formed their youth, watching their friends die as they fought the American proxy in Iraq. These are the people that were hardened by war since they were 16, 17 years old. This is the people that are now running Iran. They're not going to back off. They want revenge. They want justifiable revenge. Because, again, let's remember one thing. When's the last time Iran started a war on its own? When's the last time Iran started a war with somebody? 200 years ago. When's the last time the U.S. started a war? Half a year ago, not counting this one. U.S. has spent almost an entire history fighting somebody. It's got like about 13, 14 years of no wars. Iran had 200 years. It didn't start wars. I'm not saying it didn't fight wars because wars were started against it. But it was for 200 years. It did not initiate any conflicts. So this is a very different country. This is a country where the people are defending their homeland from their women and children being murdered by indiscriminate shelling. You're talking absolutely different levels of motivation. U.S. does not have a moral high ground. There was no rally around the flag for the president. That's why they're constantly changing the reason for this war, because they don't know how to sell it to the public. And if they have to go with a draft, and apparently they're not considering a draft, you're going to have massive civil unrest, if not a civil war in the U.S., because the majority of the population is against it. So that'll be very interesting to see. But when the butcher's bill comes due, if they're crazy enough to do this, I don't know how Trump stays in power, honestly speaking. A lot of Republicans will abandon. Nancy Graham there, Lindsey, he'll run off the moment he feels that he's threatened. Believe you me, he's a rat, and he's got a rat that's looking out for himself first and foremost. Trump just happens to be a convenient ship for him to sail on at the moment. And remember, he was one of the anti-Trumpers at his own time. So, I mean, a lot of these Republicans, by their own political logic, they will abandon Trump in a heartbeat. They follow him because he's popular, not because they like him. And they're going to look out for their own skins, first and foremost. So when this goes south, that support for the imperial presidency is going to get real thin.
Do you think, I'm just looking at the various comments on where the claims of America implementing a draft, but just a last question on that front, on the ground invasion. Do you think it will happen, if you had to guess based on everything you've said? And then I want to get your thoughts on Iran's military strategy as well, and the strikes on the Gulf, the retaliation to the gas plant attack as well by Israel. But first, do you think you will see troops on the ground?
If we had a logical regime in Washington, no, this wouldn't happen. It's suicide. Anybody, any general that's worth his weight, that's not out looking. Well, unfortunately, they're all political. That's how they get chosen these days. Any general that understands that should be resigning in protest, they won't, because resigning in protest means no more prospects of million-dollar careers after military service. That's the unfortunate part about the American system these days. Again, if anybody looks at this realistically, logically, in a sound mind, they would never do this. Will they do it? You know, I don't know. I pray that they're smart enough not to do this for the casualties on both sides. But the U.S. is looking at a meat grinder it's not prepared to deal with. By the way, there's pretty much a blackout on news in the U.S. I mean, any real news on what's going on. So as happens in every war. I mean, if you ask the average American, in 2014, 2015, 2012 about Afghanistan, he'd probably ask you, we're still there? I mean, that's the level of news blackout on all of these things. Very, very minimal. And they just avoid talking about it. And it just goes away because they block off the airways with everything else. Now, of course, the Americans are facing about 30% rise in the cost of gasoline. And that petrol isn't going to go down anytime soon. I mean, the U.S. could put price ceilings in. They could put export controls in. But then the donor class would lose money. And that would take a lot of willpower off the from the president to actually do that.
By the way, just quick update. So as you're speaking, just kind of give you an idea of the war. Like, there was ballistic missile launched towards southern Israel from Iran. As you started the interview, Hezbollah claimed to have struck an IDF tank. Minutes later, ballistic missiles launched from Iran towards southern Israel. And then minutes after that, literally simultaneously, alerts are sounding in Dubai reports of air defense interceptions in the marina area that hits close to home, because that's where I live. But Yeah, that's all happening as we're speaking. And it kind of links to the next point, is what could Iran do? And I want to start with another question I've been thinking about. And that's, Iran still has enriched uranium hidden somewhere. We've mentioned it early on in the interview.
Sure.
It's at about 60% enriched uranium. Now, to get it to 90% takes a couple of weeks, depending who you ask. And that amount of enriched uranium is enough for 10 to 12 bombs. So putting all that together, is there a possibility, is there a risk that Iran, if it's boxed into a corner, or even now, that they develop some sort of, you know, small nuclear warhead and use that either as a deterrent or either as a strike to try to end the war? Because a lot of people are talking about Israel using a nuclear warhead, which I think is extremely unlikely, but I'm surprised how many people are actually bringing it up. But I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well, but mainly on the Iranian risk.
Well, if Israel uses a nuclear warhead, there's a nuclear power plant about 100 kilometers, 120 kilometers south of Jerusalem. That nuclear power plant will be destroyed, and that's going to cause nuclear meltdown in the core, and you're going to have fallout in that region. Israel's pretty small. Sure, it'll go outside that region, but it'll still hit. I think this time of year, the winds are going more northwest, so it would still cover Tel Aviv, areas like that. And never mind the ballistic reserves that Iran has, would still wipe out a very good chunk of Israel.
If they have the launchers, we don't know if we have enough launchers.
Well, they have plenty of launchers. I mean, come on, the missiles are going. The reason is, look, the reason you're not having this big of a launches right now is you're in phase three. Phase two, most of the, you launch in the phase one, you wipe out the eyes, the radar systems. So you go from having a 40-minute window of notification and opportunity to react to about a 3 to 4 minute window of opportunity to react, because that's the radar systems have been destroyed. Now you're looking at what phase two then becomes. You just keep shooting and shooting, not so much to necessarily the hit as to use up the enemy's defensive missile capabilities. That's when Hezbollah can launch 200 missiles and 25% of those get through, because Iron Dome is worn out, arrows worn out. U.S. is pulling PAC-2 missiles into the Patriots, the older missiles that aren't really designed for ballistic missile interception, just to have something to be able to shoot. The THAADs are out, and the U.S. manufacturing base is pathetic when it comes to this. I mean, look, the U.S. hand manufactures missiles, by the way, because that's how you maximize the cost of these missiles and maximize the profit. Patriot missiles are produced at about 35 to 40 missiles a month. THAADs are produced at about 9 to 10 missiles a month at $12 million a missile. By the way, that's nothing. That's not even one night's worth in a month if you shift everything there. The SA-4s are pretty much so done. You still have SA-6s on the larger ships and aircraft carriers. But you know those aren't being used. They're kept in the back to keep them out of missile range. So what do you do at this point? There's nothing for the Arabs. You can put up the only thing you have left is you can put up F-16s in the air and use their air-to-air missiles to try to take out these larger drones and take out the ballistic missiles. Not the best choice to do it, but they can be done. But, you know, you're going to go through air-to-air missiles pretty damn quick if you do it that way. And I think they are doing it this way at this point. When you get to phase three is when you start pulling out the new toys. You've used up the old toys. You still have, you use up what's left and you start putting on the new toys. And then, for example, the hypersonics. And then you're just doing, targeted hits on exact targets. Instead of saturation runs, you don't need to do it. Now you're starting to do targeted destruction of enemy facilities, enemy personnel, and so on. That's the phase we're in now. Iran has plenty of missiles. I've seen the videos of the tunnels. The U.S. is being, like it or not, U.S. is being proxied back by Russia and China. And why not? U.S. has proxied Russia for 4 years. What goes around comes around.
So I've asked this question to a lot of people. You think China and Russia are using Iran to proxy the U.S., to weaken the U.S.?
Why not? Absolutely. U.S. does it to Russia. The U.S. will do it to China the first moment they have. In fact, it does it through a company, through an organization like USAID, trying to get
it can't do it into a rebellion.
So, yes.
It can't. So, two things. Number one, it's doing it through China, through Taiwan, by defending Taiwan, but it's not directly doing it the same way as Ukraine, because China is not part of any ongoing war, hasn't been for decades. So, that's why You can't.
No, but it, you know,
there's no wall.
There's Western. What's it called? Western Turkmenistan, or basically Western edges of China that has a Muslim population. The U.S. has been trying to proxy that for a long time, rise up rebellions, and through Tibet also. So, yes, the U.S. does that. U.S. has been trying to push India into a war with China for years now. The Indians just happen to be a bit smarter than to go into a suicidal war with China. So far, anyways, hopefully that will continue.
The previous question and the last question is the risk of a nuclear bomb by Iran. Do you think that this is a risk that should be taken into consideration as well? Because not many people are talking about it, unless I'm missing something militarily.
Look, the guy that kept the moderate, that kept nuclear weapons as forbidden, was killed on day one by the Israelis or by the Americans. I'm not sure who struck him first. I think it was the Israelis. His son, who fought since 17, he can go around that far. He's the now religious leader. And I think more like, you know, if I was running Iran, I'd have I've already had nuclear weapons. Difference between Iran and North Korea. North Korea can reach out and touch Alaska. They can reach out and touch Hawaii. They can definitely take out any American allies and bases within East Asia, down possibly to Guam. And the U.S. isn't going to touch them. They're not going to touch them because they're afraid of them, because they have nuclear weapons and they will strike back.
But in terms of the difference, really on the fatwa, the fatwa is it's a religious statement, a religious ruling that can be reversed. Yes. So the new Supreme Leader can reverse it, and then if. And also there's an argument being made by the people that believe Iran could be building nuclear weapons, is that if you don't want to build nuclear weapons, why enrich to 60% in the first place? My answer is this is a deterrent. This is more of a threat. Like, if you twist our arm, exactly. If you twist our arm, we will build a nuclear weapon. If you don't twist our arm, if you don't attack us, we won't build one. Well, the arm has been twisted and the war has been started. So does that mean there's the incentive to build a nuclear bomb, whatever your stance is on Iran, the incentive from a self-preservation perspective is there, and the risk should be taken into consideration?
Absolutely. Look, if I was running the show, I would be developing nuclear weapons right now. Absolutely, that would be the easiest thing. You don't have to drop on Jordan or on Israel. You go out in the desert and you blow one up as a test and say, we've got three more right now on warheads somewhere in the mountains, and everything ends really, really quickly. That's the reality of it. The moment you're dealing with a nuclear power that feels existentially threatened and is willing to use nuclear weapons, everything changes. The logic changes fast. And by the way, is going to be the message that's already been sent to every single regional power in the world. You want the U.S. off your back? Build nuclear weapons fast. We're going to see a massive Trump. Trump has just... Yeah, he destroyed the world order. I mean, I'll give him that. We're not only economic recession and possible depression in large parts of the world, not only civil unrest in large parts of the world, including the U.S. allies, not possibly toppling of regimes in the Persian Gulf, up and down these little dictatorships that were backed by American military power. I mean, we're going to see a lot of changes in the next year, half a year, and a lot of these. But everybody that has half a brain cell working is going to go, oh, nuclear weapons. Whether they're developing them or buying them, they could easily buy them from Pakistan. They could easily buy them from North Korea. There's going to be a big market for nuclear weapons for everybody around. The genie's out of the bottle, and everybody's seen, North Korea doesn't get attacked. Iran got attacked. Why is that? And that's an obvious answer.
Stanislav, as we're wrapping up, just got a report now from one of our sources. We're trying to verify it. But there's a lot of reports coming out that there's a direct strike of an Iranian ballistic missiles in Dimona, where the nuclear power plant is in Israel. And maybe I could just quickly... And there's multiple injuries are allegedly reported there. How significant is that if the nuke plant was actually struck?
It depends where you strike it. The nuclear towers, the cooling towers, I mean, they're designed so they can withstand a strike from a Boeing 747 slamming into them. Destroying the cooling towers is difficult. But what's not difficult, which, by the way, the Ukrainians have been trying to do when Zaporizhzhia power plant and in the Kursk power plant when they had the Kursk incursion, which was only about 10% of Kursk, but it gave them the range. was to strike the coolant systems and the backup generators. If you strike the coolant systems, the system that pumps the water in to cool the tank that has the nuclear power rods in it, you could have a meltdown relatively quickly after that. They will heat up. They will go critical. Critical isn't a chain reaction like on a nuclear bomb. They'll go critical heat. They'll melt down, and then they'll go melt through the bottom because the level of the heat, they'll melt through the bottom, and you will have a steam explosion. What saved Chernobyl was three guys went underwater underneath where the water reserve was, and they drained it before the core was able to melt its way down to there. Because if the core had hit that water reserve, you would have had a massive steam explosion that would have covered even more of Europe in nuclear fallout, because the radioactive material would have been up in the atmosphere with the steam. So yeah, it's if you take out the coolant and you take out the back out or you take out the power generators that are used, you can actually get into them to melt down. I mean, look, electricity is generated. It's actually not generated. It's excited. You don't create electricity. The electrons are already there in the wires. You get them going by getting the magnets moving. You get the magnets moving in different variations. How you do it with steam. But steam turns the generators. It's the question of how do you heat the water? You heat it with nuclear. You heat it with gas. You heat it by burning coal. You heat it by something. Something that's generating heat. So in this case, I mean, you have to have a lot of water, A, for the steam, and B, for the coolant in nuclear power plants. So, you know, if you take that out, you're going to have a lot of problems, and you could have a nuclear meltdown.
How much damage or can one ballistic missile cause a nuclear meltdown?
Again, it depends where it hits. If it hits the coolant facilities.
One ballistic missile in the coolant facilities is enough?
I'm not talking about the coolant towers. I'm talking about the equipment that the pumps, the regulators for the coolant. If you take all that out, I mean, I don't know what kind of ballistic missile they fired. You don't know, you know, did they hit straight in? Did they wing it? But theoretically, yes, that's what the Ukrainians have been trying to do with field artillery, shooting at the Zaporozhye power plant, trying to hit the coolant facilities. It was a big enough danger that the Zaporozhye power plants have been shut down. I mean, there's minimum amount of coolant that has to go in there, but they're not working right now. Why? Because there's a threat that the Ukrainians would start a nuclear meltdown, just because that's the people in power there. And if this hits, this could be a serious thing. But again, let's not forget, the Israelis already hit the Iranian nuclear power plants. Thankfully, they didn't cause a nuclear meltdown. I mean, this is getting very close to a total catastrophe. And the Israelis have already caused a catastrophe, one catastrophe. So, you know, with the oil fire. So this is spiraling out of control, very, very quickly out of any remaining control.
Wow, yeah. All right, Stanislav, really appreciate it. We'll be getting developments on this. So people, by the time we post this interview, people will probably have more clarity on the whether this is true, this report is true, and how much damage it is. But I am seeing a missile video now of a missile avoiding two interceptors and landing in southern Israel just moments ago. So it's pretty significant development. But Stanislav, absolute pleasure as always to have you on the show. Thank you.
Yep. Have a good day.